Christian Gospel with Dr. Alyssa Elwine. Join us around our Shabbat dining table as we explore the Torah portion.
Hey, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. What I'd like to do is just continue a little bit. Again, we're in the footsteps of Messiah. Our working text right now is Song of Songs, chapter 4. But I'd like to just take a look back at last week's lesson and kind of bring us into the present, because if you'll remember last week, what we reviewed was the silence at the crossing. We talked about the different kinds of crossings that had to take place. First of all, we have the precedent of Jacob crossing, he says, this Jordan with his staff. And the understanding there is just like with his descendants, the 12 tribes, when they crossed the Jordan with Joshua, with Yehoshua, that the Jordan also parted for Jacob and his sons when he crossed over that first time. So we've got that seed prophecy there. We might say the paleo version of the prophecy. And then later in the Torah, we have the 12 tribes crossing again. And in between there, we had a crossing of the Reed Sea, and we contrasted those last week, how the crossing of the Reed Sea, when the waters parted and they were able to go through on dry land, that this parting of the waters was an exit. They were exiting destruction. They were exiting a state of being lost. They were exiting a state of slavery. But crossing the Jordan is a matter of crossing into inheritance. So there's definitely a difference between crossing out of and crossing into. And either way, we see that destruction of kings was linked to those crossings. And the crossing of the Reed Sea, of course, their exiting from the realm of death resulted in the death of Pharaoh and his armies when they crossed the Jordan. The promise was that if they would listen this time, if they would not repeat the mistake of the 10 spies and give a bad report and just think that they were incapable of crossing into their inheritance, then they would have divine help. And what maybe they were unaware of is that he had already loosened the authority of the Canaanite kings that were there. The Israelite tribes were there just to mop up after the Holy One. He was going to go before them and take care of their enemies. And that if I could leave you with one thing today, and if I could leave you with one thing for all time, never forget when life seems overwhelming, when the obstacles seem insurmountable, that no matter how big or how impossible the job seems to you, you're basically just along for the ride. You're the mop-up crew. The Holy One's going to go before you. Any enemy that needs to be taken out of the way, any enemy whose authority needs to be loosed in order for you to step into your authority, he goes before you. And if you say, oh, I don't know if I can do that at all, well, you're not supposed to. Who do you think's doing this? Who do you think's running this operation? You were there to mop up after him. He lets you do that. He lets you go basically just step into your place and pick up the loot after he's done driving away the Canaanite kings. He lets you go back to the seashore. And if there's any loot floating on the water from Pharaoh's army, then you can go pick up the loot after he's done destroying them. So it's not your job to destroy the enemy. And it's not your job to be afraid of the enemy. It's your job to believe that if you're walking in the path that he has set out for you, then in those moments when it's time for the enemy to be destroyed, for you, it's just a matter of stepping into that inheritance. And that's really all Israel had to do. The impossibility that the 10 spies saw, it was because in their eyes, the power of the Holy One was really not very much at all. After all they had seen and after all they'd experienced, somehow in their minds, he just wasn't that strong compared to the Canaanite kings. So you've got to figure out, is there any area in your life where you have diminished the power of the Holy One to destroy that enemy? After all that he's done for you, after he has brought you through the seasons of life to this place, He has kept you alive. He has sustained you, and he has brought you to this season. And as you look back on those miracles, which of those miracles do you want to diminish? How small is the Holy One? How unawesome is he for us to think that he cannot complete the work that he started in us? And that's the message that the 10 spies overlooked, because they had not grown in terms of understanding the awesomeness, the one they served and the one who led them out. They perceived themselves as incapable. When you don't attribute to the Holy One the awesomeness that he is due, that's when you walk around saying, I can't do it. What you're actually saying is, he can't do it. He can't do this. He doesn't have this. He's not going to take care of me. And it comes across as, oh, I can't do it. I don't know. I don't know if I'm able. I'm incapable. I don't know. I think I'll fail. What you're saying is, you think he's going to fail. And that's sobering when we think about it, when we belong to him, that when we diminish our calling, what we're in effect saying is, he's just not that great. The one I serve is just not that great. So we want to turn that around. We don't want to make the same mistakes as the Israelites did when they heard the evil report of the 10 spies. What we want, and see, here's the thing. We actually read this. Tyler Merwin read this at River of Life today at service. The passage where Adonai basically tells the Israelites, okay, all right, I'm going to turn you around here into the wilderness, and your dead bodies are going to fall in this wilderness. If you don't think I'm any bigger than that, then, you know, according to your word, so be it unto you. Let your corpse fall in the wilderness. But he basically said, your children are going to suffer for you because of your unbelief. Your offspring, your children are going to be wandering out in this desert for 40 years. And that's the link I want to make today. When we fail to be the spiritual giants of our generation, will we suffer? Yes. But who's going to suffer on our account? The next generation. And what did they do wrong? But nevertheless, there are consequences when we don't step up, when we fail, when we refuse to be these shields of faith. In our generation, we're not the only ones who wander in the wilderness. It's the next generation who suffer from our failures. So as we look at these crossings, we say they had the offer of a crossing with Moses. They didn't take it. In fact, when they changed their minds, they were defeated miserably. You know, Adonai is not a God of second thoughts. Well, on second thought, maybe he can. Don't treat him that way. He's not going to take kindly to that. He's not your second thought. He's your first thought. And so Moses tells them, don't go up. They're like, oh, we'll go now. We've changed our minds. Like, no, too late to change your mind. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for this generation. And I think that's our message too. In every generation, we have to ask, what is the Holy Spirit doing in my generation? And am I moving with the Spirit, or am I about to get run over by it? And there doesn't seem to be, at some point, because remember, they've had some issues up to this point. It's not like they're blameless all the way up until they reach the Jordan and decide not to go over. They've been complaining all along, but he's been willing to set that aside. Well, there comes a point where he doesn't set it aside anymore. He says, okay, you're going to suffer the consequences of your faithlessness. You don't believe me. You don't believe I'm awesome. Okay, die. I'll take your spirit. I'll save your soul. But you're going to die without pressing into your inheritance. Your inheritance will be delayed. And not only that, your children, the next generation, are going to suffer because of your unbelief. And so it matters what we do in our generation. We have to know what the Spirit is doing in our generation, because there will be certain points. We might have made mistakes in the past. But just like with Pharaoh, there came a point he had hardened his heart. He says, okay, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. I've contended with him. His spirit will not strive with us forever. And so if we've acquired a habit of refusal when we know to do good and we don't do it, there will come a point where his spirit will quit striving with us. Doesn't mean we're not saved. It just means that we're not going to press into the reward, into the inheritance that was available to us. And it means that our offspring can suffer. The generation after us can suffer because of our unbelief. The strides that they could have made in spiritual places kind of go in circles until that generation reaches a maturity where he says, okay, now in your generation, the window's open. What do you want to do? Do you want to follow Yehoshua? Do you want to go defeat these Canaanite kings who were already defeated 40 years ago? I defeated them 40 years ago and you didn't know it because you didn't believe me. And so, okay, now you, this generation, is the window is open. Will you follow him or not? And they followed him and the sea parted, the Jordan parted for the Israelites. And so we have to ask in our generation, what is he calling me to do? We're going to talk about a calling today. What is he calling me to do in my generation? Have I reached a window that will only be open for a short time for me to go through it in order to press into an inheritance that it won't be the same? Should I refuse to take this walk with him? Should I refuse to believe that he will part the Jordan? Should I refuse to believe that he's already conquered my enemies, no matter how big they look? And so that's the point, is why are we tying together the parting of the Jordan for Jacob, the parting of the Red Sea for the Israelites, and then the parting of the Jordan again for the Israelites? Because the point is rehearsal. Remember, this second Jordan crossing, it occurs during the week of Passover. It occurs during the week of Pesach. And so there's a repetition. There's a pattern here that we can follow and say, okay, we know that prophecy is repeated often on the feast days, or sometimes the fast days. We just came out of Tisha B'Av. There's a history of calamities that occur to Israel on Tisha B'Av. So we have to be very careful, you know, as we approach not just the feast days, but the fast days. Stay sober-minded, stay in a state of repentance. Keep our eyes open for those windows so that we don't, like the 10 spies on Tisha B'Av, come back with an evil report and say, he's just not that awesome, guys. I know what Moses has been telling you about Adonai, but he's just not that awesome. We've seen how big the stuff is in the land. We've seen how big the problems are. We've seen all the conspiracy theories and the UFOs and what else is going around right now. It's, you know, there's conspiracies everywhere. There's corruption everywhere. There's wickedness everywhere. There's every kind of wickedness in every high place. And you know what? Our God is just not that awesome. He just can't deal with these people. Or we can bring a good report and say, like Yehoshua and Caleb, you know what? These people, as wicked as they are right now, they've been set up for us. He has set them up. He is about to bowl them over, and we just have to walk into our inheritance. We just have to expect that he's going to part the Jordan again and lead us into our inheritance. But we have to rehearse so that we won't miss that window. That's what we see in prophecy, is he's given us certain windows of time that we need to be on high alert. We need to be at DEFCON infinity because when these windows open at the feast times, we are ripe for living in prophecy. And so we've been rehearsing. We've rehearsed our feasts. We rehearse every week at Shabbat. If you're not rehearsing every week at Shabbat, a window could be open that you completely miss, or a window could be open that you're just too big a chicken to go through because you just don't think he's that awesome. If we have a habit of saying how awesome I am on Shabbat, and therefore let my will be done instead of his in heaven, I don't care what Yeshua's custom was on Shabbat. I don't care if Yeshua did assemble in the synagogue on Shabbat for the reading of the scripture and assemble with like kind and like mind. I don't care what his custom was. I'm much more awesome than Yeshua. So I get to determine how I spend my Shabbat. I think Shabbat is a nap. Well, Yeshua did take naps, but he tended to take them in boats for some reason. He wasn't big on Shabbat naps. He was big on serving others on Shabbat. So every week we get an opportunity, a window's open to serve, to say, oh, how awesome he is, instead of, oh, how awesome I am under every green tree on our feast days. We get the opportunity to say, oh, how awesome he is, instead of, oh, how awesome I am. You know, I know Sukkot's one of those things in the Bible, but I think I'd rather go to Disneyland. Oh, how awesome I am. And oh, how awesome Disney is compared to the Bible. Do we want to say things like that? Of course not. We know better than that. But how easily we slide into that way of thinking. So our rehearsals, what we do each week relative to the Shabbat, what we do each week preparing for the Shabbat, what we do each year relative to the feast, that's going to be the key for us so that we begin to see ourselves differently. Because what is it doing? It's changing the way that we see him. And when it changes the way that we see the one we serve, then it begins to change the way we see ourselves. We begin to see ourselves as the giants, and we begin to see the enemy as grasshoppers. So that's where I want to pick up today. So again, the generational point here is rehearsal. When we fail to be spiritually prominent, remember, this is our working text. It says, your neck is like the Tower of David, built with layers of stones, on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the warriors. And so we saw in other lessons how the 1,000 shields do refer to the descendants of Abraham and Sarah, 1,000 generations, the covenant that's extended to 1,000 generations. And remember, that's a representative number. Don't sit down and try to do generational math with it. Just like there are 70 symbolic nations, we know there's well over 70 nations. It's a symbolic number. So 1,000 is the symbolic number of Sarah and Abraham's generations. And so each generation needs to be a shield within its generation. But the example we have here at the failed Jordan crossing is that we only had a few shields that were prominent, that they had necks like the Tower of David. Because remember, Tower of David is seen to be symbolic of the Temple Mount and the temple itself. That means a landmark. And so your spiritual stature is what this neck like the Tower of David represents. It's conspicuous. It sticks up above the crowd. It's built with layers of stones, just like the Temple Mount, on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the warriors. These are the warriors of their generations. These were the shields. Remember how many times Moses interceded for a people that really didn't deserve it. And so you've got to pray for people who really don't deserve it. Adonai, you know, he offers this, hey, I'll make a nation out of you. We'll get rid of these other guys. Well, you say, that's not really what you're asking me. You're testing my heart. You want me to intercede. You want there to be salvation. You want there to be repentance. And so in every generation, we have prominent people like Moses and Aaron in their generation. And in the next generation, you're going to have Joshua and we might say Caleb, but we also, you know, we might look at Eleazar, the next high priest. He will figure prominently in that generation. But in every generation, there are people who will stand up and speak the truth in spite of the circumstances. Even when it looks like the whole generation has fallen down, there's always a few who will stand up and speak up. We have to be shields in our generations. We have to be the link so that the next generation doesn't suffer unnecessarily. Now, from their suffering on account of their parents, maybe that's what helped to shape them into the mighty generation that they became under Joshua. But you don't want to do that on purpose. The previous generation was still responsible for the suffering that they imposed on the next generation. It's like the next generation prevailed in spite of their parents. We don't want to be a generation of parents whose children will prevail in spite of us. We want to sow into their lives faith and faithfulness and truth so that we're part of their story in a good way, not in a shameful way. And so we don't just give up on our kids. We give up on our kids when we give up on ourselves. When we say, you know what, I'm just not strong enough to do what he's calling me to do. What have you done? You just gave up on your kids. When you give up on yourself, you give up on your kids. And if they do prevail, they will prevail in spite of you instead of because of you. We want to avoid that. We want to be part of the shield of our generation, because not one shield's going to be missing when it's over. The only question will be, out of these 1,000 generations, are you considered part of the shield of your generation? And we want the answer to that to be yes. I want to be, you know, whatever he's called me to be. Has he called me to be a housewife? Then be the best housewife you know how to be. Has he called you to, I don't know, work at the water treatment plant? Then you be the best water treater that ever lived, right? You be that landmark in your generation. And you teach his word as you go, no matter what you're doing. You sow that into the next generation. A mom might be sowing that into her children. That guy that goes to work every week at the water treatment plant, he might be sowing into the younger workers at his job site, into that next generation. There's always a next generation around you. So they need to see you rehearsing. They need to see how you are transformed by keeping Shabbat. They need to see how you're transformed by keeping the feast and how it keeps prophecy uppermost in your consciousness, because you know that you're part of it. You are living, breathing in a time of prophecy. So as they're getting ready to cross the Jordan, remember Joshua told the Israelites that they needed to pass this story on to their children for the future generations. It's the same way that Moses told them to pass on the Passover story to their children for every generation after them. And so this is how you're linking into the next generation. You're becoming the shield so that there's no empty places. You're showing and teaching your children so that in their generation, their shield can rest right beside yours, or in some cases can rest on top of your foundation. We have to quit badmouthing people that we feel fell short in our lives and appreciate the foundation that they did lay, so that we can just take their work the next step up. Because sometimes the work of a generation is going to be on the same row of stones, and sometimes the work of a next generation is going to be on a layer of stones that's one step higher. But we don't speak gossip, we don't speak evil or ill of a generation because they did not attain everything that we attained to. In effect, I think that's a shield that needs a whole lot of polishing to get its attitude right. So we don't go around blaming people for not meeting the standard that we feel like we have reached. Don't badmouth what's going on in the church. You appreciate what you learned in church. You appreciate what you learned in synagogue, but now you're following Yeshua. And so you thank him that he, you know, Adonai knew what position you needed to be born into. He knew the exact family you needed to be born into in order to become a giant of faith, to have a neck like the Tower of David, to be conspicuous in your spiritual growth. He knew exactly which family you needed to be born into, because he knew in some cases you needed the boost, you needed that particular foundation. In other cases, he knew that you had the type of personality that if there were failings, you would say, I'm not going to make that failing. I will take that failing and I will use that as my boost. He knows our personalities. And so we're without an excuse. We can't blame our parents. We can't blame the church. We can't blame the synagogue. We can't blame anybody. Because if he is full of awesomeness, then he is our father. He is our foundation. He chose our circumstances. So here's the thing I want to emphasize about the Moedim. Remember, these are rehearsals to prepare us, to polish us as a shield in our generation, to open that way for the next generation instead of making it much harder on them to become warriors themselves. Basically, you know, that first generation in the wilderness, they're usually perceived as a generation of losers. A generation of losers. But you notice how that when the daughters of Zelophehad approached Moses about having an inheritance because their father had died, they didn't badmouth their father, really. They acknowledged he died, but he died for his own sin. You know, he wasn't caught up in one of these rebellions that occurred. He didn't join himself to that. But yeah, he did die for his own sin. And so it was kind of a nice way of saying, hey, we're not blaming our dad. We just want our inheritance. And we need that same attitude. We don't blame our parents. We don't blame the church. We don't blame the synagogue. We don't blame anybody. I just want my inheritance. I just want to cross over. I just want the Jordan to part and have a place to, you know, I want a fig tree to sit under, or a vine to sit under. You know, I want a fig cake every now and then, and I want to go up at the feasts. And so that courage, of course, that helped open the sea. It helped open the Jordan. So going through these feasts, they rehearsed in the wilderness for 40 years. They rehearsed the Moedim. Another word for Moed or feast is Mikra. And depending on which version of the Bible you have, it might say a holy convocation. And that's what it is. It's a meeting. It's a convocation. But it's kind of a multi-purpose word. It's an extremely interesting choice of words to describe a meeting, where you're called to meet together with a group of people. If something just happens randomly, it's kara. In modern Hebrew, when you meet somebody or you're saying hello, you might say makara, which means what happened literally, but it really means what's up. If you put an English equivalent to it, what happened? You know, what's happened to you this week? What's happened to you since I've seen you? Well, happenings can be random, like stuff just happens, or a mikra can also be a planned happening. In the case of a mikra, a feast, a moed, to the unspiritual eye, it might look just like a random feast, like y'all just picked a day and decide to have a holiday. But it's quite the opposite. When we have a feast, it doesn't just happen. It's not random. It's not chance. We didn't just pick a day and say, this is going to be a day that we commemorate such and such. It will have a definite connection to something we need to remember, and it will be planned to happen over and over and over. Sometimes what we don't understand about a mikra or even prophecy is that what might look random to the unspiritual eye, there's kind of a method, there's a paradigm that goes with it. And this paradigm is open for us to understand. Remember, to 1,000 generations, to the 1,000 round shields, if you were Israel, if you were called to the feasts, if you were called to the Shabbat, if you were called to the Torah, if you were called to obey the word, then this prophetic method of engagement, it's available to us. It's not hidden. It's not secret. It's been around for a long time. It's been written down since Mount Sinai, but it existed even before that. So the 1,000 round shields, 1,000 generations, Israel, the descendants of Sarah and Abraham, it's available to us to learn about it. A mikra. So I want to show you two Strong's entries for kara, the root word there, the shoresh is the root. The first one here is going to be a Strong's 7122, which is kara, and it's spelled kuf resh aleph. And you can see from the definition here, kara, it says it's through the idea of accosting a person met, right? It means to call out, to address by name, to bid, like the old English kind of bid, like come here, to call forth, to cry to invite a guest, to mention, to even preach, to proclaim, to pronounce, to publish, to read, to say. Now it makes sense what a mikra is. It's a calling. When people are called forth, they are cried unto. Remember, wisdom cries in the streets. When is she crying? Well, most specifically, she's crying at the feast times. Remember, they're not random. They don't just happen. They're a matter of invitation. When you invite someone to something, the invitations go out long before the actual date of the event. The guests know far in advance of the event. Remember the parables that Yeshua taught about sending out invitations to the weddings and so forth? The guests had plenty of time to send answers back as to whether they would be there. Well, you know what? We never want to send an answer back that, you know what? I'm not going to be at Shabbat. I got other things at work to do. I'm sorry. I just can't make Passover this year. I'm sorry. Oh, that Sukkot thing. Yeah, we did have a family vacation scheduled during that time, or we've already used up our family vacation. We did need to go to Disneyland. So I'm sorry. You know, Adonai, you're just kind of out in the cold on that one on Sukkot. Thank you for the invitation. We just won't be there this year. My goodness. Can you imagine? But sometimes we don't even think about how it sounds when we tell him we won't show up or don't show up. He sent the invitation and we said, you know, we didn't, our RSVP was like, you're just not a VIP in my life. I'm the big VIP in my life and I decide what I do at my appointed times. And so thank you for the invitation to call me, to preach to me, to proclaim to me, to publish to me your word, to read to me your word, to make yourself renowned, to call me out in my generation. Thank you so much for the invitation. I can't accept this week your invitation. I just can't accept this Passover, your invitation. I just can't accept your Sukkot invitation, but thank you so much for trying. Wow. That puts it in a whole different light, doesn't it? Because it's not random. It can be, Kara can be random. And that's why I say there's two sets of eyes. One set of eyes will see it as kind of a random thing, just kind of a chance, a happening, and it happened. But another set of eyes says, wait a minute, this is my calling. This is what I'm called to do in my generation. I'm being called out. I'm being preached to. I'm being invited. I'm part of a publication. So here's the other kind of kara, and you'll notice it's spelled identically. Kuf, Resh, Aleph. It's identical. And in this case, it means to befall, to chance, to happen. In other words, it's random. It's absolutely random. So compare the same word. And even here in the etymology, it tells you it's identical. The first one, the one that is not random, 7121, it is not random. But it says it's identical to 7122, which is random. So which is right? Yes. That's how we answer a lot of questions when it comes to Hebrew. Yes, it depends on the context. You have to know the context of how the word is being used to know whether it's referring to something that's completely random, chance, or whether it's a calling, it's something specific. So I'm going to give you three examples. The first two examples, clearly, you're going to see them match one of these definitions. And then the third use of it, you're going to see it match the other definition, right? So Genesis 42, 4, it says, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, I am afraid that harm may befall him. Now, right here, Jacob doesn't have anything specific in mind that's going to happen to Benjamin. He's just saying it could happen. Traveling was seen as a very dangerous endeavor in ancient times. Sickness, robbers, sick animals that would fall down with you, cheaters, all sorts of things, especially if you're traveling to exchange merchandise. And so in this first instance, Jacob's not saying, well, here's this specific thing that's going to happen. It's just something could happen. This is the chance definition. And then again, Genesis 42, 38, Jacob says, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey, if harm should befall him, he doesn't know of any specific harm that he knows is going to happen. He says, if it should happen on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. So these first two examples, these first two mentions of Korah, 7122, clearly from the context we understand, Jacob just says, it could happen. There just might be some random thing that happens, just bad luck, wrong place at the wrong time. But let's take a look at the third use of it. Right? Genesis 49:1. It says, then Jacob summoned, and that word there is Vayikra. It's the same word we're talking about, Vayikra. He summoned, he assembled his sons. Well, right there, that's not a chance. The 12 sons didn't just randomly assemble in one spot one day. They just somehow, by pure luck, all ended up in the same place with Jacob. He summoned them. It was planned. It was on purpose. When you are called to Shabbat, when you are called to the feast, you are summoned. It's up to you whether you answer. It's up to you whether you show up. Vayikra. He summoned his sons and said, assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. All right. We're still dealing with 7122 here. Befall. But it's the same as this Vayikra. When he Vayikra his sons, he assembled his sons. It was an invitation. Come here. And then he says, I'm going to tell you what will befall you in the days to come. He already knows what's going to happen to them. This is not a chance happening that he wants to tell them about. He has summoned them in order to tell them what will happen. This is not going to be, this prophecy that he's about to give them is not a matter of luck. It's not random. It's not chance. It's prophecy. And he says, I want you to be prepared. And so when Adonai assembles us, Vayikra, on Shabbat, when he assembles us at his feast, it's so that he can tell us what will happen in days to come. Because remember, one of the meanings was to publish, to preach. What happens when we assemble on Shabbat? There is a publication of his word. There is a preaching of his word in the assembly. It's not the same. Now, could Jacob have sent this word to each of the 12 sons, written it down in a note, or emailed them, each in their 12 houses? Would he have had to assemble them in one spot in order for them to receive the prophecy? Theoretically, he could have sent not emails, but tablets, I guess. He could have sent it, you know, had a scribe write it down and take it to them. He didn't. He summoned them. He said, assemble, get together. Because if you want to understand prophecy, if you want to understand what will happen in days to come, then you need to understand it's not just chance. So the assembling, that's why we're told, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together, as is the manner of some. What they want is the email. What they want is to stay in their PJs and watch the live stream without having to be around real people. Some people don't have a choice. They don't have any other people around them. It's like kind and like mine. There's no other tribe around them. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about people who could get themselves out of their PJs and they could go to Shabbat service, or they could get themselves out of Disneyland and go to Shabbat service, or they could get themselves out of the ball game and go to Shabbat service, or they could get themselves out of the camper and go to Shabbat service. They had opportunities. They've been summoned. They've been invited. Assemble yourselves so that I may tell you what will happen in the days to come. I would suggest that the less you answer the summons, the less awareness you are going to have of what will happen in days to come. We're interested in the second Exodus. How are you going to learn about the second Exodus? Will it be a secret knowledge? Will it be a secret website? No. It's been written since ancient times what will befall you in days to come. But something special happens when you assemble yourselves, when you heed the invitation for the publication of the word. That's when you begin to understand what will happen, that these things are not simply by chance. We don't want to fall into the sin of the 10 spies who felt like somehow their arrival at the promised land was luck, random, just something that happened. They lost their grasp on the prophecies going all the way back to Adam and Eve, that there would be a restoration eventually. They lost the handle on it. Their assembly became dysfunctional. They assembled, but for the wrong reasons. Not for the publication of the word, but for the publication of their own will, for the publication of their own perception, for the publication of their own shortcomings. Don't assemble for the publication of shortcomings. You want to assemble for the sake of publishing the famous one, the one who created heaven and earth, the one who set our appointed times, the one who has decided how prophecy will go and has decided what our role will be in it, should we choose to accept the invitation. So we look backward to the defeat of the Canaanite kings. What were they so afraid of? Giants? No big deal. Abraham lived next door to giants. Didn't bother him. He made friends, right? That's a lesson to us. What are you afraid of? Just make some friends. They won't be there forever. They're going to get cleared out. The Canaanite kings had already been defeated. They were defeated at Mount Sinai. When Israel became a people there at Mount Sinai and said, we will do, we will hear, when they said, we will obey, the belts of the Canaanite kings, their authority was stripped away. But the Israelites didn't see it that way. Somehow they thought the Canaanite kings were strong. They thought the giants were bigger than the one who called them, the one who assembled them. Why would they think such a thing? Here's what happens in Numbers 13:30. It says, then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we surely will overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land, which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone and spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size, of great height. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, are part of the Nephilim. Remember, Abraham used to hang out with these guys. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight. You see, one followed the other. When they saw themselves as grasshoppers, then the Canaanites saw them as grasshoppers. What do you want to be? Do you want to look at the wickedness around you and say, that's huge. I'm just a grasshopper against all the wickedness in this world. Well, if that's the way that you think about it, then that's the way they're going to perceive you. But if you're a Caleb and a Joshua, you're going to terrify them because you have a neck like the Tower of David. You understand the one who has built the temple. You understand the one who has assembled you as a people. And you understand it doesn't matter how high they are. If they're higher than the trees, they're still not higher than their creator. He made giants. He's a creator. Giants can't make themselves. He made everything. And so even demons have to obey him. He's the creator. So how do you want to see him? When you think you're a grasshopper, you're saying he's a grasshopper. That's not the approach we want to have. So here's the idea that Will Panor brought out, which is a Hebrew language school, in a newsletter they did recently. It was the two life philosophies, the grasshopper versus the ant. And they pointed out, because the Israelites now think they're grasshoppers. And so even though the grasshopper is kosher, the grasshopper, like the locust, it has no thought for future generations. It just eats its way through life. It just lives to eat and reproduce. But we're told to look at the ant as an example. The ant lives for 6 months and it works the whole time. It gathers food. It gathers the nesting materials. It gathers all this stuff that, for the most part, it's not going to live long enough to eat it or enjoy it. It's preparing food and lodging for the next generation. It doesn't think about, well, gee, I won't get to enjoy all this. Let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's the attitude of the grasshopper. But the ant says, no, I'm going to lay a foundation for the next generation. So they might be the tiniest little thing, but we're told in Proverbs, look at the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. What does she do? She prepares for the next generation. When we fail to prepare for the next generation, we're sluggards. We're grasshoppers. We're just eating our way through life. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Why do I need to worry about assembling myself to hear the publication of the word? Why do I need to worry about assembling with like kind and like mind to understand what is going to happen in future times? It's because this ant is building a bridge for the next generation. And that's the question. Whose ant are you? You say, well, I don't understand the question. Let's just take something easy. The daily news. How many of us spend more time reading the daily news and updates than we do the Torah portion? At the end of the week, are we more well-versed in politics, weather, sports? What's on the news? What, anything on the daily news? Conspiracies, corruption. Are we more well-versed in that than the Torah portion? If we are, probably by the end of the week, instead of being prepared to assemble in a very specific way to be part of that bridge for the next generation, instead, you feel overwhelmed, you feel tired, you feel like wickedness is winning, and then you feel like, am I just doing any good here at all? Am I making a dent in anything? Is there any point to my even being here? Or do you just see giants? Sometimes the wickedness of the world feels insurmountable because there's so much of it. But truthfully, if the answer is yes, if the wickedness of the world, the news, the daily news of the world if that feels insurmountable to us, to the point it just kind of freezes us, makes us want to turn inward, we're the grasshopper. We become a grasshopper in our own eyes. And when we become a grasshopper in our own eyes, then the wicked of the world, these things that we perceive as giants, we look like grasshoppers in their eyes too. We're just really no problem. All this screaming and confusion that's going out in the wickedness of the world. You know what you have to do in that situation? You have to grow a neck. Your neck just needs to get taller and taller and taller. Your spiritual stature needs to grow higher and higher and higher, because the daily news should not overwhelm you. You should never feel as if you're not doing any good here, as if you're not laying any foundation, if you're not an ant making. Have you seen ants make bridges out of their own bodies, like from tree to tree, to get from this leaf on this tree to this leaf on this tree? They'll make a bridge out of their own bodies to get to that other tree. They don't look at the gap between the two trees as insurmountable. They just say, if we assemble ourselves, then our lives won't be lives of chance and luck. Then we'll live lives according to our calling. And we can bridge between here and here. And we can open up for the next generation another source of food, another place for them to feed and to grow strong. Because that's when your perception changes. You realize what the 10 spies didn't realize, but Caleb and Joshua did. They knew who the true giants were. When we answer our calling, when we assemble ourselves for the publication of the word and we walk in that word, then we are spiritual giants. We have necks like the Tower of David. We are conspicuous. People can't miss us. You know what? The wicked need to see you. They need to see you doing good. They need to see you assembling. The more confusion that they fall into, the more they need to see order in your life. And it's a divine order. It's been there from the creation. Shabbat has been there from the creation for you to assemble. The feast days have been there from the fourth day of creation for you to assemble. When you understand that, that's when you start perceiving yourself as the spiritual giant. And you say, wait a minute, all this corruption, that's a grasshopper. All this crime, that's a grasshopper. All this untruth, that's a grasshopper in my sight, because my view is Jacob's view. I know what is going to happen at the end of days, and I'm going to be part of it. I'm not going to make the next generation miserable just because I felt overwhelmed. Instead, I'm going to step up. I'm going to do my job. I'm going to proclaim his word. I'm going to live according to his word. And every time the invitation goes out, I'm going to show up in good clothes, not dirty clothes. I'm going to show up dressed for Shabbat. I'm going to show up dressed for Passover. I'm going to show up dressed for Shavuot. I'm going to show up dressed for Sukkot. And I'm going to drag my kids along because I am building a foundation in them. And so will they lag and drag and fuss and fight and do all that stuff? Of course they will. They're teaching. You're teaching. And they're learning. You're disciplining them to hear the publication of the word. And part of that, what do you do at the crossing? You remain silent. You're showing them what it means to remain silent and just let Adonai do the work on our behalf. It's just our job to show up and clean up. Show up and clean up once his presence goes before us.
Thank you for exploring the Torah portion with us. For more information on this ministry, go to thecreationgospel.com. You can find links there for our newsletter, books, workbooks, Facebook, and our YouTube channel.